Welcome to the Mission Health Partners podcast. Today, we will be sharing a presentation from our annual in-person provider meeting that we held last month. We had the pleasure of having Dr. Vinny Tohan speak this year on congestive heart failure. Dr. Tohan completed his residency and cardiology fellowship at Baylor College of Medicine, where he remained on faculty in the section of advanced heart failure transplant and artificial mechanical support. He was recruited to Wake Forest University School of Medicine in 2006 to lead their advanced heart failure program, where he rose to the rank of full professor. He then was recruited to Milwaukee, Wisconsin to lead a 15-hospital health system, performing 75 advanced heart options annually. He returned to North Carolina in 2019 and joined Asheville Cardiology Associates. The program under his leadership has performed over 150 LVADs for people in our region in need of life-saving therapy. He has over 170 publications and is a nationally sought-after lecturer. We were so grateful to have him as a speaker this year. We hope you enjoy.
So the title of my talk tonight is going to be Heart Failure for My Primary Care Colleagues. And really, it's broader than that. It's probably nurses and nurse practitioners and other APPs. This is super important. I think every one of us touches the lives of patients and families who suffer with congestive heart failure. And this is just a teaser and a little bit of a primer. I was told I had like 60 or 70 minutes tonight to do this. So no, I don't. It's like 20 minutes or something like that. So I have about 100 slides. So I'm going to talk really, really fast, and you guys have to listen really, really, really slow. I have about 25, maybe 30 slides, and we'll kind of go through this. I'll try to emphasize the details and then de-emphasize some of the things. I think all of us realize that the heart is an amazing organism, as much as the pulmonologists in the audience feel like the heart actually just provides blood flow to the lungs, and the nephrologists in the audience say that really it's the heart is only there to provide blood flow to the kidneys. The reality is, without the heart, none of these organs function. The average cardiac cycle is 0.8 seconds. There's over 2 billion cycles over the course of a lifetime. The stroke volume of a normal heart is 70 cc's, that's 5 liters per minute, or 183 million liters over the course of a lifetime. The heart can enhance its cardiac output by 400%, and it's really amazing feats occur in an organ that's about the size of a closed fist and weighs less than a pound. So what can go wrong? Obviously, we wouldn't be here tonight discussing congestive heart failure if we didn't feel that things could potentially go wrong. Congestive heart failure starts with some form of myocardial insult, and those are varied in nature. They can be ischemic, valvular, hypertensive, tachycardic, toxin-mediated, metabolic. A variety of different disease states can conspire to lead to some form of myocardial dysfunction. That reduces systemic perfusion, which then initiates a host of inflammatory and hemodynamic defense mechanisms that can be elicited. And when these systems are upregulated on a chronic basis, that leads to altered gene expression, apoptosis, remodeling of the heart, and eventually this diagnosis of congestive heart failure. So it's sort of the sustained upregulation of these cardiotoxic mediated events that eventually results in changes in heart structure and function and leads to patients having congestive heart failure. And it is the dysregulation of the sort of bad elements and relatively good elements that result in this concept of congestive heart failure. So with that sort of pathophysiology in mind, I'm giving you a cross-section of a heart here. I don't have it moving, but can you tell me which of these two hearts is a patient who has congestive heart failure? Anybody in the audience? You didn't know that you were going to get called on in the back, did you? So if you're standing up in the back, no, I'm just kidding. They were getting really nervous back there. Someone's like close to the beer. Okay, the reality is that either of those or none of those could have congestive heart failure, because remember, congestive heart failure is a clinical definition. And it is a clinical syndrome that can result from any structural or functional cardiac disorder that impairs the ability of the heart to fill or eject blood. And so it's a syndrome. A syndrome is basically a constellation of signs and symptoms that taken together suggest the presence of a disease. And then, of course, signs are things or objective features of an illness. That's things that we elicit from our patients. And symptoms are subjective features of an illness that are related to us by patients. And so it's the combination of signs and symptoms that actually lead us to the next step, which is either making a diagnosis in patients. And so what I would say is that heart failure really comes in a few flavors: heart failure with a preserved ejection fraction and heart failure with a reduced ejection fraction. And what happens over time is a normal heart remodels because of that injury that I talked about into one of these two phenotypes. And once it does that, you get these structure and functional changes that can alter the disease course. This is a nice representation of why these two very disparate looking illnesses actually phenotypically present almost exactly the same way: shortness of breath, dyspnea on exertion, sometimes chest pain, difficulty with your day-to-day activities. This is the reason why that happens. For whatever reason, pressure inside the left ventricle, whether the ventricle cannot empty blood or cannot relax fast enough to fill under low pressures, results in elevations in left atrial pressure. That then backfills into the pulmonary circuit. That causes shortness of breath with either rest or with activity. That leads to hospitalizations and disability, which eventually leads to death. And what we do is we utilize medications to stop different components of this illness in its tracks. And so when we talk about congestive heart failure, there are 6.7 million people. There's an annual incidence of 660,000. There are over a million hospital discharges, and it is the single largest Medicare expenditure for probably the last 15 years. There are 6 million outpatient visits. Heart failure, again, is the single largest expenditure. 80 to 90% have pre-existing heart failure, 77% with class 3 or 4 symptoms. This is important. Mortality for an index hospitalization is 4%. The readmission rate, or the mortality at 90 days, is 10%. And at 12 months is 30%. So if you have a hospitalization for heart failure, it is a signpost in the road that basically is saying danger ahead. 50% of these patients that are admitted once are readmitted within 6 months, and some of the initiatives that MHP are putting into place is to try to drive that number down. We know that hospitalizations predict outcomes. And if you look at median survival, and it's dependent on hospitalizations, for that first hospitalization, the median survival after that first hospitalization is about 2.5 years. If you go to the fourth hospitalization, the median survival is about 0.6 years. That's worse than most metastatic cancers. And so it's one of the few major cardiovascular diseases that's increasing in both incidence and prevalence. And I said that there were two flavors. Now there really are three flavors. And it's sort of heart failure with a preserved, heart failure with a reduced, and then this heart failure, which the Europeans call between, but in the States we called mid-range ejection fraction. And those are ejection fractions between 41 and 59%. So if a patient has signs, symptoms of congestive heart failure, the next step is to get an echocardiogram and then to segregate patients into these three categories. The interesting fact is that irrespective of whether you have a low ejection fraction, mid-range, or a normal ejection fraction, your outcomes are very, very similar. And if you look across the kind of 5-year event rates for patients, most people will have a heart failure hospitalization or readmission, and their mortality rates remain exceptionally high for this population of patients. So what are the therapies that are out there? I'm not going to go through this slide in detail. I will underscore the fact that I started my medical school in 1995, so there were really no drugs with the exception of ACE inhibitors at that time. And then I guess because I was in school and then eventually discovered all these other drugs, there's a lot of other drugs that are out there. I did not discover any of these drugs, by the way. So. But there's a host of other medications that are out there. I think I will underscore one of the newer medications that are out there. These are SGLT2 inhibitors, or sodium glucose transport channel inhibitors. This is the new kid on the block These have sort of revolutionized our ability to care for patients with congestive heart failure. They block specific receptors. These receptors prevent resorption of glucose, so you pee out glucose. When you pee out glucose, there's an osmotic gradient where you pee out fluid as well. And this decreases blood sugars, and it does it in a non-insulin dependent manner. And so there are lots of mechanisms that may potentiate benefits for congestive heart failure patients. I will not go through the details. But there is data to support the utilization of these class of agents. And I say class, there's two FDA-approved agents, three if you want to decrease hospitalization. But they all basically do very similar things. And if I do a meta-analysis, like which has been done, the meta-analysis demonstrates about a 28% reduction in heart failure hospitalizations, and that is on top of standard three-drug medical therapy of the time, including Entresto. And if you take a look at a meta-analysis of all of the data that's out there for this class of agents, there's about a 13% reduction in death from this. So it decreases hospitalizations, decreases death, and it's one of the four pillars of therapy that we have for the treatment of congestive heart failure. And if you think of patients who have a reduced ejection fraction, and you apply these four therapies, ARNIs, which is Entresto today, beta blockers, three different types of beta blockers, MRAs or mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists, or aldosterone antagonists. There are two types that are out there, and the several SGLT2 inhibitors. The relative reduction in the risk of mortality is 73%. The absolute risk reduction is 25%. And the number needed to treat to have a reduction in any of these events is less than four patients over 24 months. So if I could ask MHP to do anything, is to promote the utilization of these agents in these class of patients, because it's a life-saving therapy. It's not only a life-altering therapy. So I will switch gears here a little bit and turn to heart failure with a preserved ejection fraction. Remember that category whose ejection fractions are more than 50%. And I'll put heart failure with a mid-range ejection fraction kind of grouped into this also for now for the purposes of medical therapy. So 41% to 49 and then 50 to whatever, 50 to 65. All of the therapies for heart failure with a preserved ejection fraction, none of them are life-saving, they're all life-altering. And that's important to recognize. There's really been three major drug classes that have looked at this. And whether you look at SGLT2 inhibitors like we just spoke about, RAS inhibition or MRAs, you'll find that they all reduce hospitalization, but they do not affect mortality. And so no therapies currently improve mortality. SGLT2 inhibitors have a 2A recommendations, MRAs a 2B recommendations. And this is new compared to when I was training and when I first started out practicing. Beta blockers don't improve outcomes in this population of patients. And I would say with one caveat, and that is individuals that have atrial fibrillation, keeping their heart rates, you know, in the 70 to 90 range is probably reasonable. And if you need a beta blocker to do that, that's not an unreasonable thing to do. Now that leaves an awful lot of room for drug discovery, in fact, in this population of patients, either drug discovery or device discovery to help patients who have heart failure with a preserved ejection fraction. We've got a lot of therapies with reduced EFs, but with preserved EFs, we really don't have anything that saves lives as of today. We do have some ideas on different therapies. This is a very busy slide. I'm not gonna go through this in detail, but this looks at the concept of obesity and obesity therapies as they relate to heart failure with a preserved ejection fraction. About 40% of patients with HFpEF, up to 40% I should say, have obesity, depending on how you define obesity. There have been two studies that have looked at this combination of obesity and heart failure with a preserved ejection fraction. And I would just highlight the fact that while they reduce hospitalizations, the event rates are very, very low in this population of patients, and the study durations were not very long. So these GLP-1 receptor agonists, which are exceptionally popular, semaglutide, tirzepatide, and various other agents have been studied in patients with heart failure and a preserved ejection fraction. And what we've found is that they do decrease the composite of cardiovascular death or worsening heart failure, but they predominantly decrease worsening heart failure events. And so in this very large meta-analysis, it decreased heart failure death and heart failure hospitalization and cardiovascular death by 32%. 46% of patients had lower heart failure events, but there was no effect on mortality. And some of the key criticisms is that all of these patients had obesity, and about 60% of patients who have heart failure with a preserved ejection fraction are not obese. So what would these medications do in that population of patients? And then the follow-up, it was relatively short in this patient. There was a lot of heterogeneity in this population. The event rates were low. And what we don't know is how they actually work. We don't know how they work to reduce hospitalization and heart failure with a preserved ejection fraction. And I would say what would happen in non-obese patients, we haven't studied these class of drugs in non-obese patients with preserved ejection fractions. And finally, the real question is what happens if either you can't afford the medicines or you get taken off the medicines, what happens to with patients with preserved ejection fraction? What we know in obesity is that patients regain the weight. And so the concern is that applying a drug and then having to take the drug off of patients is not an ideal solution. Nonetheless, there's going to be 10 other studies that are going to come out for this, 50,000 patients. They're going to look at BMIs between 25 and 35 with and without cardiovascular disease, and their endpoints will be robust. And so I will kind of end with just the topic of advanced heart failure, which is really the topic or the reason that I came to Western North Carolina. When I came here, there was we provide every aspect of cardiovascular care with the exception of heart transplantation in our region. And at the time, there were really very few of these life-saving LVAD therapies or left ventricular assist device therapies that were being implemented in patients in Western North Carolina. And we know that for every million patients out there, there's probably somewhere between 500 to 1,000 patients that qualify for advanced heart failure. And so these patients fall into this advanced heart failure phenotype. And there are roughly 200,000 across the United States. These are exceptionally sick patients with a mortality upwards of 50%, and there are limited medications that can alter this disease state. And so there are several markers. I'll just skip through this very rapidly, but I think an easy acronym to remember for patients with low EFs who need help is I need help. So if they're in the hospital with inotropes, if they have advanced symptoms, if they have end organ dysfunction, if their ejection fraction is low, they've had defibrillation, and remember that kind of marker of poor things to happen in the future is hospitalizations, low blood pressure, or down titration of medical therapy. So if you're having to decrease your ACE inhibitor or your beta blocker in these patients, that is not a good sign. I've come up with like the mission mantra: if your age is less than 75 and your EF's less than 25, you should probably get an evaluation of some sort or another, at least see one of us so that we can see if you'd be eligible, see if your patient would be eligible for advanced heart failure therapies. There are devices that are available. We have utilized cardiac resynchronization therapy. It improves functional capacity, heart failure morbidity, and even saves lives in this population of patients. I was around in Houston when this technology was being developed. Dr. DeBakey and Dr. Cooley had started this kind of technology in the late 60s, but then really it morphed into a much more usable technology in the mid 90s. And then by 2008, it had become miniaturized and was fully implantable technology. This device basically takes blood out of the left ventricle and provides vital blood flow via conduit to the aorta. And so the device itself spins very rapidly, sucks blood out of the left ventricle. And this slide represents about 30 plus years of data. And what it demonstrates is that there has been improvements in people's survival with LVAD support over the last three decades. And if you take a look at heart transplantation compared to the most recent version of these support technologies. Heart transplantation and these support technologies are equivalent at 24 months. In our program, at 6 years, we have the same outcomes as other programs who have heart transplantation. So comparing a heart transplant with an LVAD patient, we have the same outcomes. There are two different versions. Really, now there's one version. The most recent version decreases the event-free survivals, and so we can see survivals of up to 68% in our population at 5 years in this very advanced sick patient population. So I'm going to end here. I'll say that heart failure is a final common phenotype of various different cardiovascular insults. The incidence and prevalence of this disease is increasing, with preserved ejection fraction outnumbering reduced ejection fraction. Quad therapy, which is ARNIs, beta blockers, MRAs, and SGLT2 inhibitors, are indicated. They're class one indications for patients with reduced ejection fraction. They dramatically alter morbidity and mortality. SGLT2 inhibitors and the treatment of patients' comorbidities are important for heart failure with a preserved ejection fraction and mid-range ejection fractions. GLP-1 based therapy for heart failure with a preserved and mid-range ejection fraction has really only been studied, at least in a robust way, in obese patients, and I would advocate consideration for those patients, as it does decrease hospitalization, does not change mortality that we're aware of. And then, of course, early referral for advanced heart failure options. We have LVAD, but we have a direct line for transplantation as well. We've performed now 156 LVADs over the course of the last 10 years or so, about 70% of those since 2019. And we have a great relationship with our transplant programs out there for those patients that are transplant eligible. All right, well, thanks a lot.
Before we end, I wanted to have Todd Day, our manager for our adult care management team, share more about our new CHF program.
We have, over the last 3 years, MHP has worked to expand our care management offerings by developing these diagnosis-based programs. We started with COPD and asthma, and in the process, we were able to not only dramatically improve our patients' health care, but also drastically reduce their rate of admission to the emergency room and into inpatient stays. Last year, in 2024, we started our diabetes program, and as Karen mentioned, for the patients that were able to complete our program, 83% of them saw a drop in their A1C. So this year, we're turning our sights on congestive heart failure. As with all of our diagnosis-based programs, the premise is really simple. Our goal is to help the patients understand their treatment plan that they develop with their providers. With CHF, we're doing the same thing. We're also looking to help them understand the disease process itself. We help them understand their medications and why they're taking what they're taking, and also to help bridge any gaps in their ability to obtain those medications. Some of these are expensive medications. We provide guidance and education on diet and lifestyle, the importance of weighing every day, and then who to call and when to call when new symptoms come up. The foundation of all of these programs, and as well as with CHF, is our cross-team collaboration. Our RNs identify the patient initially and do an assessment, and then also continue to guide and drive the remote care coordination. But then built into the program, we have home visits with each of these patients from our care medics. So they can not only go in and actually assess the patient in person, look at the medications, how they're taking their medications, but we can also see how they're living with their diagnosis. We can see what's in their kitchen. We can see what supplements they may be taking that may not go with their medications. And if we have orders from their doctors, we also can do things like do lab draws or get an EKG. And even if the patient is not able to get in to see their provider, because of transportation or maybe physical debility, we can also facilitate telehealth visits with the cars that are issued to our care medics. They actually have built-in satellite Wi-Fi in their vehicles. all of our patients, whether they're in one of these diagnosis-based programs or just somebody that we encounter from, say, for instance, being discharged from the hospital, we evaluate their social determinants of health needs. Our community outreach specialists are the experts in that field. And then for any behavioral health needs that may come up, we also have our LCSW available. Now, our primary way of identifying patients for these programs traditionally has been to call them after they've been discharged from the emergency room or from an inpatient stay. But of course, our effectiveness is only amplified if we can target these individuals and intervene before those events happen, before they actually go to the emergency room, before they end up in the hospital. So if you have a patient in mind that you believe would be, that we could help, please send your referrals to mhpreferrals@hcahealthcare.com for a secure email, or you can also fax to 828-213-6195.